Jim Blackhorse looked up from the scythe he was sharpening when he heard his wife calling him.
I'm in the barn.
Jim!
He propped his scythe against a stall and walked outside.
I hear you, dammit. I said I was in the barn. What is it?
Seeing him then in the barn door, she ran toward him, obviously disturbed.
In the garden. I think there's a dead man on a horse.
Where?
In the garden. I went to the garden to dig potatoes, and he was just sitting there dead.
Sufficiently concerned now, Jim dropped his file and ran toward the garden after his wife. Rounding the corner of the house, they stopped at the edge of the garden. As she had said, there was a big gray horse standing in the middle of his fall peas, munching on the leaves. In the saddle, a man sat slumped, his arms hanging limp at his sides, his chin upon his chest. He appeared to be an older man with long, dirty gray hair hanging below his hat brim.
Lord have mercy.
Jim could hardly believe his eyes. His wife could be right. The man looked dead to him, too. He hurried down between the rows.
Easy, boy. Easy.
The big gray gelding had no thoughts of running and just continued eating the leaves.
You need to get that horse out of my peas.
Look at this.
Jim pointed to the man's blood-soaked shirt.
Looks like he's been shot.
He took the horse's reins and led him out of the garden. Glancing back at the dead man, he couldn't help but notice the left arm was missing a hand.
Damn.
Bobbing up and down with the horse's rhythm, the body listed to one side and began to lean over. Jim quickly reached up to steady. Suddenly, the corpse came to life with the touch of Jim's hand on his arm. Startled, he jerked his arm away and fumbled with his saddle sling in an effort to draw his rifle.
Mister, we don't mean you no harm. We're Christian people. Looks like you've been hurt bad. Let me take you in the house where you can lie down and we'll try to help you.
Much obliged, friend.
He fell forward on the horse's neck, unconscious. With his wife's reluctant help, Jim was able to carry the wounded man inside the house.
Oh, Jim, we can't put him on our bed. He's filthy. He'll ruin that spread.
The man's hurt. We can't lay him on the floor. Now swing his feet around that way so I can set his shoulders down.
Once Blanton was settled on the bed, Jim proceeded to take a closer examination of his patient. He took his hat off and hung it on the bedpost.
I expect he's as old as I am, maybe a little older.
The cruel eyes, now seemingly peaceful in sleep, did not appear so threatening beneath the heavy black eyebrows, giving the deadly predator an appearance more closely resembling that of a tired old man.
Let's take a look at that wound.
Jim began unbuttoning Blanton's shirt. After some difficulty, he managed to remove the shirt and hand it to his wife. She took it with the same emotion she would have displayed had it been a dead skunk.
Oh!
It might take a lot of boiling in the wash pot to get all that blood out.
I expect it would be best to wash it in cold water. Hot water will likely set the stain in.
Looking now at the blood-soaked underwear, he decided that he would have to cut it away, preferring that to stripping Blanton naked. Once he got down to bare skin, he was better able to evaluate the extent of the damage.
I ain't a doctor, but I'm pretty sure that's a gunshot wound.
He looked at Lily, hoping she might suggest the best way to treat the patient. He was answered with a blank stare.
Well, we'd best clean it up. You better heat up some water.
After the wound had been cleaned up the best the two of them could manage, Jim pressed a bandage to it to stop the bleeding.
Looks like he's lost an awful lot of blood. That's probably why he's so weak. Well, that's all I know to do for him. He'll most likely need something to eat to get his strength back when he wakes up. If he wakes up, I'll put his horse in the barn.
It was well past supper time when the patient regained consciousness. Roy opened his eyes slowly, listening to the noises around him, again wondering where he was. Feeling as if his side were on fire, he turned his head cautiously toward the sounds emanating from the kitchen. It came back to him then, and he remembered the circumstances. He started to get up, but quickly lay back down when he realized how weak he was. Hearing the patient moving on the bed, Jim came in from the kitchen.
Well, we was wondering if you was gonna come to or not. How you feeling? I reckon you could use something to eat, huh? My wife's got some stew that we had for supper. It'll help to get your strength back.
Roy paused for a brief second while he studied his Samaritan, aware of the good fortune that brought him to this couple.
Friend, I'm much obliged for your kindness. I thought I was a goner when I was set upon by a gang of cutthroats and robbers on my way home to Texas.
He sat up a little more in the bed.
I reckon I ain't ready to ride again quite yet.
Robbers? Where were they?
A ways north of here on the road to Broken Bow. They're long gone, but they left me in a sorry state. I guess the Lord was guiding me when I bumped into you.
Oh, he must have been watching out over you. There's some pretty mean boys hiding out in the nations. We're kind of off the main trails here, so we don't see many visitors. That's the way me and my old lady like it. I'd say you're lucky you got away with your life. Looks like you've had your share of bad luck, How'd that happen?
Jim nodded toward Blanton's left arm.
Cutting timber. My arm got in the way of an axe. Where's my horse?
In the barn.
My saddlebags?
Oh, it's safe and sound, just like you left them.
Like I said, I appreciate it.
Oh, we're glad to do what we can do for you. I just wish I knew more about taking care of a gunshot wound. I'm Jim Blackhorse. That's my wife, Lily, in the kitchen.
Jordan. Roy Jordan.
Blanton shifted his position.
Did you get the bullet out of me?
Oh, no, sir, I didn't. Tell you the truth, I was afraid to go digging around in that wound. I didn't see no hole in your back, so I reckon it's still in there.
Roy frowned. He had hoped that Jim had taken the slug out of his side while he was asleep. He supposed that he would have to have a go at it himself, but not before he felt a little stronger. He knew a few men who were walking around with bullets still in them to no ill effect.
What about some of that stew you were talking about?
I'll go see if it's done.
Lily was much more willing to tend to their patient after Jim told her that Blanton was an ordinary citizen who had suffered the misfortune of falling prey to a band of outlaws. And all misgivings disappeared when he complimented her on her cooking. They went to bed that night, content to sleep on blankets on the kitchen floor while Blanton occupied their bed. Another day and night passed before Blanton felt recovered enough to take up his mantle of vengeance again. The bullet had been too deep in his side to remove, so he decided it best to leave it where it was. The bleeding had stopped, and along with it, most of the pain. As Jim had said, there had been no visitors to the isolated farmhouse, so his recovery was without complications. His hosts had received him graciously, fully accepting his story about searching for coal deposits and having a wife and daughter back in Texas. On his feet again, he strapped on his gun belt as if to leave. Jim and Lily watched in fascinated interest as he flipped open the cylinder on his .44 and spun it with the stump of his left arm to make sure it was loaded. Clicking it shut again, he cocked the hammer back and pointed it at the puzzled face of Jim Blackhorse.
Thanks for the hospitality.
Blanton calmly replaced the two cartridges with the man and his wife lying dead at his feet. He had nothing against the man and his wife who had come to his aid, but it had struck him that their little farm was a perfect hideout until he felt completely recovered. According to Jim and Lily, there was no family close at hand to drop by unexpectedly, and no visitors as a rule. It was just what he needed. He might have spared the couple's lives a little longer to cook for him, but it would have been a nuisance to have to continue to play his part. He was free now to plunder the house, take what he needed, and rest up another day or two. He didn't like the turn of events that had cast him in the role of the pursued, and he kept reminding himself that he would once again become the hunter. After a full day's ride with nothing to tell them they were on the right trail, both deputies were nearing frustration. It was Buck who expressed his doubts about the wisdom of continuing on until reaching the red.
What then? I don't know what you think, but I think we're just farting in the wind. We ain't seen no sign of nobody following this trail. That old son of a bitch is laying low somewhere. Probably laughing at us running around here like a couple of dogs chasing their tails.
I couldn't have said it better. I've been thinking that maybe he was wounded a lot worse than we think. And he had to go looking for help. What about Ida Bell? Is there a doctor there?
I don't know. I ain't been to Ida Bell since the railroad laid tracks there. They didn't have one before that when they used to call it Purnell. But the railroad, I wouldn't be surprised if they did now.
I'm thinking Blanton might have lost us a ways back when we passed that trail we figured led to Ida Bell. He might have gone there looking for a doctor.
Well, ain't no more of a long shot than the one we're riding on now. Matter of fact, it makes more sense. Will you say we head west till we strike the railroad and follow it on up to Ida Bell? If we run across this trail heading toward the red between here and the railroad, we can jump on it then.
How the hell are we going to know if it's Blanton if we do run up on a trail heading south?
Well, now that's a fair question. We wouldn't know whose tracks it was, would we? Hell, let's just go to Ida Bell and see if anybody's seen him.
It ain't my fault the damn cow gets out. Sis is the one that always forgets to latch the gate. Pa ought to make her go look for the damn cow.
Tommy Snow's sister's defense was that it was difficult to make sure the latch caught when she was carrying a bucket of milk. He gave the mule a kick with his heels. The mule trotted for a few yards and then settled back to a slow walk to further irritate Tommy. Ordinarily, he wouldn't mind searching for the stray milk cow, but he had just finished his chores and was planning to take a pole and some worms down to the creek. The troublesome cow was not in the usual places she favored when on one of her little vacations. The last time she got out, he found her way over to Jim Blackhorse's cornfield. Maybe, he thought, she remembered the way over there this time, so he headed the mule in that direction. When he reached the lower end of the field, there was no cow in sight. He was about to turn around when he happened to look up to see a circle of buzzards that looked to be over the upper end, closer to the house. Riding up between the corn rows, he slid off the mule's back and walked the last few yards. Looking up, he saw that he was directly under the circle of scavenger birds, but he saw nothing that could be attracting their attention. He crossed over a couple of rows and almost stepped on Lily Blackhorse's face.
Damn!
His heart leaped straight up into his throat, and he jumped backward so suddenly that he fell through the stalk. Scrambling over on his hands and knees, he crawled back to peek through the corn leaves to make sure he had seen what he thought he had seen. Lily stared up at him with eyes wide in shock. He almost gagged when he saw a line of ants making their way across her face toward an ugly hole in her forehead. Looking beyond her then, he saw Jim Blackhorse, his body sprawled awkwardly where it had been dumped. Tracks in the soft soil testified that the two bodies had been dragged into the field. The horror of his discovery came to strike him like a hammer, and he quickly looked all around for fear that whoever had killed them might be now watching him. For a few moments, Tommy's arms and legs did not seem to respond to his command. He remained frozen there on his hands and knees for what seemed like an eternity before his trembling limbs began to work again. Creeping slowly and cautiously, he backed away until he reached the row where he had left the mule. Offering a quick thanks to God that the mule was still there, he jumped to his feet and ran, afraid that at any second he might hear a gunshot. Once on the mule's back, he flailed desperately with his hands and feet to provoke the stubborn animal to run. After what seemed like an eternity, Tommy made it back to his house.
Cha! 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 Pa! Pa!
Tommy charged into the barnyard.
Damn it, Tommy. I told you not to run that mule like that. The cow's already back in the barn. She was right there on the other side of the garden.
Pa! Murdered! Both of them, the black horses. I saw them in the cornfield. Both of them shot in the head.
What are you talking about?
Tommy breathlessly related all he had seen at the neighboring farm.
Get into town as fast as you can and get to John Raintree.
Yes, sir.
Wilson ran to fetch his shotgun. Seconds later, he was galloping toward the Black Horse farm. As Wilson approached Black Horse's cornfield, he reined back to have a look around him before getting too close to the house. Flock of buzzards now making up the circle over the upper end of the field was testimony enough to confirm what Tommy had told him, that the black horses were dead. He rode between the two rows. Then, as Tommy had done, he dismounted and walked cautiously toward the top of the field. Before he got as close as his son had earlier, he was stopped short by the sight of a buzzard already dining upon the bodies. That was enough for Wilson.
Let the police do their job.
He turned and retreated back to his horse. The two deputies pulled their horses up to the railroad depot in the little community of Ida Belle and dismounted just before noon. Inside, they found the telegraph operator sitting at his desk eating his dinner.
Can I help you, fellas?
Yeah. Is there a sheriff or engine police or something in this town?
There's John Raintree. He's Choctaw Light Horse, but you missed him by about an hour. You ain't thinking about a holdup, are you? Because there ain't no money in the safe.
I reckon we don't look like much more than a couple of saddle tramps, do we?
Casey displayed his badge.
We're deputy marshals, and we're trying to run down an outlaw that might have passed this way.
Like I said, you just missed John by maybe an hour. Wilson Snow's boy came storming in here looking for John. Said somebody killed Jim and Lily Blackhorse. Said he saw them laying in their cornfield, shot in the head.
Casey and Buck exchanged quick, anxious glances.
How far is it?
4 miles, maybe five.
Where? How do we find a place?
Head north. Just past the general store, there's a road on your right. Follow it till you come to a creek, about 3.5 miles. Then you'll just have to look sharp after that for a wagon track leading off to the left. If I remember correctly, there's a big oak tree right there. I've only been there once, so I'd tell you how far past the creek it is.
Much obliged.
Wilson Snow waited by the big oak tree that stood beside the path to the Black Horse farm, anxiously watching the road to Ida Belle for a sign of John Raintree. After what seemed like hours, he finally saw the Choctaw lawman approaching with Tommy following close behind. Wilson went out to meet him.
Mr. Snow?
Raintree nodded toward the path by the oak tree.
Is that where Tommy said he saw the bodies?
I saw them too. Just follow that path. It leads right past the cornfield and up to the house.
You say the bodies are in the field?
Up near the house. Just follow the buzzards.
Anybody in the house or around the house?
I didn't see nobody, but I didn't really go up to the house.
All right. I'll go see what I can find.
Want me to go with you?
I reckon not. Might be best if I scout around there by myself till I see what's what. How many horses did Black Horse have?
As best as I recall, he didn't have a riding horse, just two mules that he plowed with.
Raintree nodded, turned his horse toward the path, and left father and son by the road. Wilson had been correct when saying the bodies would be easy to find. Raintree left his horse by the path about 100 yards short of the house and proceeded on foot. He intended to get a look at the situation before actually approaching the dwelling, so he took to the woods to the right of the path instead of going up through the cornfield. Reaching a point opposite the back corner of the house, he got a better look at the banquet of scavengers as they quarreled over the now scant remains of Jim and Lily Blackhorse. It was difficult to watch, for he knew Jim and his wife, Lily. Like he, they were Choctaw, and he had often seen them whenever they came to the general store in Idabel. Forcing his attention away from the macabre scene, he moved to a new position opposite the small corral, where he discovered two mules and one big gray, almost solid white horse. This told him that the killer was still there, and equally important, there was evidently only one person to deal with. Cocking his rifle, he moved cautiously out of the cover of the trees and hustled across the narrow side yard to the side of the house. Then he slid along the wall to a window. Taking his hat off so he would expose himself as small a target as possible, he peered in at the corner of the window. The room was a bedroom, and there was no one to be seen. Ducking down to pass under the window, he moved around the corner to a front window where he repeated the procedure. Peering cautiously with only one eye exposed at the corner of the window, he again saw no one, so he slowly exposed the other eye, hoping to see through the doorway into the other room. At first, he saw nothing. Then a black circle appeared before his face.
Well, did you get a good eye, fool? You was so all fired anxious to peek in here.
Roy Blanton stood just inside the window while he scanned the trees on the side of the clearing.
I saw you when you sneaked up through the woods, thinking you was gonna bushwhack Roy Blanton, was you? Well, you ain't the first Injun lawman that's made that mistake.
Although feeling some smugness in foiling the Choctaw policeman's attempt to surprise him, Roy now had to consider the possibility that there might be more lawmen coming. It was time to leave. Buck and Casey found Wilson, Snow, and his son waiting under the shade of a giant oak tree beside the Idabel Road. After identifying themselves as deputy marshals, they proceeded to question the two.
Are you that boy that came after the Choctaw lawman?
Yes, sir.
What'd you see?
He saw Jim and Lily Blackhorse, all right. I saw him, too, just like I told John Raintree. And he's been up there for the better part of an hour, I suspect. About 15 minutes ago, we heard a gunshot.
We better get going. How far is it to the house?
About a quarter mile.
They set off at a gallop, following the narrow path that led through a dense section of woods before emerging to find a cornfield on one side of the path and a forest on the other. Standing at the edge of the path with the reins on the ground, they found John Raintree's horse. Thinking it a good idea to do as Raintree had, they dismounted and started out on foot, staying to the right of the path in the trees. A party of buzzards were now on the ground, their feast almost finished. The two men paused briefly upon reaching a point in the woods opposite the back corner of the house. There was no sign of activity outside the weathered board dwelling, and no sign of the Choctaw policeman.
Let's circle around and get a look at the front. It's quiet enough. That engine, Raintree, was that his name? He might be inside and have the situation well in hand, but I don't trust old Roy. I expect it's the other way around.
I'm afraid that shot those folks heard back there most likely came from Blanton's gun. Now he's probably long gone from here.
Maybe. Let's see what's in the front of the house.
Buck moved farther into the trees in order to gain a position where he could see around the front corner. When he stopped to wait for Casey to catch up, he pointed toward a front window and a crumpled figure lying below it.
I reckon Roundtree, or whatever his name was, found out it ain't too easy to sneak up on Roy Blanton.
I reckon.
He could see the corner post of a corral on the opposite side of the house.
I'm gonna work around to the other side and check out the barn and corral to see if that big white horse he rides is in there.
Buck nodded, intent to wait until Casey completed his scout of Jim Blackhorse's place. It wasn't long before Casey returned.
No sign of him or his horse in the barn or corral. He lit out, but we need to take a look in that house and make sure before we go chasing off after him.
Exercising proper caution, they approached the house from two sides, and as they expected, Blanton was gone. Casey stood by the kitchen table now, looking down at a blood-stained smear on the floor.
Looks like he shot both of them down right here.
Casey pointed to some additional streaks.
Dragged him out the back door. He sure leaves a trail of dead folks, don't he? Man like that needs to be shot. Same as he'd shoot a mad dog. It's way past time to be thinking about arresting him, taking him to trial.
I guess we'll have to catch up with him first. He'll most likely make the decision for us.
I'm just saying I ain't planning to waste no time talking when we catch up with that son of a bitch.
Buck held his rifle up with one hand.
Judge, jury, and sentence. Right here.
Case and the rest of the house, they found that Blanton had cleaned it out of all supplies except for a bag of coffee. Back outside, looking for signs that might help identify tracks left by Blanton's horse, it was easy enough to distinguish the Gray's tracks from the smaller hoof prints of Black Horse's mules. And from the looks of it, Blanton had fled straight down the front path. But less than 2 hours before sundown, they chose to leave the bodies unburied for the time being. If Blanton was still nursing his wound, they might be able to catch up with him before dark. If they didn't leave right then, he was liable to give them the slip again. Blanton had made no effort to hide his tracks, so there was no difficulty in following his trail. Even so, Buck swung out wide at Casey so they could both keep an eye on the tracks running between them. In a half hour's time, they came to the north-south road from the Little River, the same road they had followed a few days before. They stopped and dismounted, figuring it was going to take a close look at the collection of tracks to determine if Blanton went north or south.
Hell, he went straight across.
Casey pointed to the obvious tracks on the eastern side of the road. Both men paused then to look in the direction indicated by Blanton's tracks. No longer following the path, they led into a line of rolling hills covered with hardwood trees.
He's looking to lose us up in them hills. We ain't got a hell of a lot of daylight left.
As twilight filtered into the rapidly darkening forest, the tracks became harder to follow, causing them to slow down to make sure they didn't miss the many turns and changes in direction.
Damn, if he ain't wandering all over the place.
They came upon another almost 90-degree change of course.
Maybe he's got a fever or something. Might still be sick from that wound.
Yeah, could be.
On the eastern side of a low hill, they came to a creek. Even in the fading light, they spotted the hoof prints on the other side, where Blanton left the water and continued in an easterly direction.
He keeps turning like this, and pretty soon we ain't gonna be able to tell which way we're heading.
They followed the twisting trail for another 20 minutes before they approached another creek.
This is the same damn creek we just crossed. He's doubled back. He ain't wandering around with no damn fever. That old fox is leading us on a merry chase. We best watch ourselves. We're liable to walk right into a trap.
Yeah, we can't keep tracking him in this darkness. We got no choice but to wait till daylight to continue, and by then, Blanton could be miles away.
I don't know. I got a bad feeling about this. He sure as hell gave us a slip again, leaving us out here in the woods in the middle of the night. Could be halfway to Texas by sunup, I reckon. But I got a feeling he ain't running no more. I think, by God, he's tracking us now.
Let's go down the creek a ways and see if we can find a better place to wait out the night, in case Blanton decides to backtrack looking for us.
Riding up the middle of the creek, they went about 100 yards before discovering a deep gully cut into the bank.
That's all to do.
Buck guided his horse out of the creek.
We can tie the horses under them trees back yonder.
Yeah.
Thinking it best to keep a cold camp that night, they had to forego coffee and a warm supper.
I reckon we could get a little shut-eye, as long as one of us stays awake while the other one sleeps.
Yeah, why not? I ain't sure I could go to sleep right away. Why don't you go ahead and grab a little sleep, and I'll wake you sometime before daylight.
Suits me.
Without hesitation, Buck made himself comfortable in the gully. In no time at all, he was in the deep sleep of the weary. Casey couldn't help but think that, as Buck himself had confessed, he was getting too old for the hunt. As for Casey, he'd been truthful when he said he would not be able to go to sleep, knowing the notorious outlaw was out there somewhere not far away was enough to keep him awake. The dark hours ground by slowly but peacefully. Alert, Casey listened and watched the dark shapes of trees around him. About an hour past midnight, he decided that all was going to remain quiet, so he chose to catnap a little himself. He woke Buck.
How about it, partner? You think you're awake now?
Yep.
Buck sat up.
Had me a good little nap. I'm raring to go.
He stood up and stretched. Casey huddled up against the side of the gully, making himself as comfortable as the clay bank would allow. He closed his eyes, although he was still of a mind that it would be difficult to actually go to sleep. Sleep did come, however, after 20 or 30 minutes. Buck listened to the night sounds of the creek. All was peaceful. Thinking a smoke would be enjoyable right then, he got his pipe from his saddlebag and filled it from a pouch of rough-cut tobacco.
Ain't much left. That ain't gonna last till I get back to Fort Smith.
Oh, shit!
Buck felt the ripple in the air caused by the bullet as it passed inches from his head.
God damn it!
Buck scrambled for defensive positions in the narrow defile.
Where is he? Damn if I know. I didn't get a chance to see nothing. I just have to keep a sharp eye and wait for him to shoot again.
Yeah, he damn sure knows where we are. How the hell could he see us?
I don't know. Maybe he's part owl. I wouldn't doubt the old son of a bitch.
Buck had a pretty good idea how Blanton found him, but he preferred not to tell Casey. His pipe was lying on the ground somewhere near the mouth of the gully. As close as that first shot had passed by his face, it was a wonder the pipe hadn't been hit. There was nothing they could do but wait and watch the darkness all around them for a muzzle flash.
God damn it! Whew. He's getting too close for comfort.
There!
Casey had spotted the muzzle flash and answered with his Winchester aimed at a dark clump of bushes 50 yards down the creek. Buck crawled up beside him. Another shot came tearing across the top of the gully, this one from approximately 20 yards farther into the trees.
He's on the move. You old bastard's got us pinned down.
It was a helpless feeling. Blanton knew exactly where they were going, and he could fire and move, hoping for a lucky shot, while they could only guess where his next shot was coming from.
He seems to be moving in a circle. We can't let him get between us and the horses.
Judging from the distance between the last two muzzle blasts, Casey shifted his rifle to aim at a spot farther around to the left, hoping to be able to react quickly to the next shot. When Blanton's next shot came, however, it was from a position back to the right. Frustrated, Casey turned and fired anyway, knowing his shot was probably wasted. No more than 40 yards from the gully, Roy Blanton knelt by the creek. He'd spent a greater part of the night on foot, searching upstream for the two lawmen who hunted him, only to find they had gone downstream from the last crossing he had led them to.
No matter. I found them. And now, by God, I'll send them both of them to hell for killing my boys.
There was also another matter requiring vengeance. He would settle with Buck Avery. Avery was a double-crosser, and Roy would not abide a double-crosser. The big deputy had accepted money that was supposed to guarantee Blanton and his boys immunity from harassment. As he inserted the cartridges into the magazine of his rifle, he looked at the stump of his left arm steadying the barrel, and his anger boiled again in his veins. Hanging from his neck, a small flower bag from Lily Blackhorse's pantry held the stark, bony trophy that was his hand. The bile inside him rose even more when he thought about the difficulty in tying the drawstrings, working with one hand and his teeth.
It's Judgment Day.
Roy Blanton rose to his feet. Moving a little closer to the men in the gully, he took cover behind a sizable tree. He wanted the satisfaction of telling them their fate.
How you doing in that hole, Buck? Is it getting pretty hot in there? Ain't nobody been hit, have they?
You go to hell, Blanton! If you got any sense at all, you'll throw your rifle down and give yourself up. There ain't none of your gang left. You're getting too damn old to be running around the woods shooting at people. Give up while you still got your life.
There's your answer, you double-crossing son of a bitch.
There was a short period of silence while he moved a few yards away.
I tell you what, Buck. I'll give you a chance to throw down your guns and come out of that hole. You can trust me. I ain't the one took the money and then double-crossed you.
He moved again.
What the hell's he talking about, Buck?
Hell, I don't know. He's crazy as a bedbug.
This ain't no good waiting for him to plug one of us. I'm going out after him.
You better watch yourself. That old man's as at home in the woods as a mountain lion. You best have eyes in the back of your head.
Yeah? Well, I'm tired of waiting around here doing nothing. I can crawl around in the woods as well as he can.
Casey waited until the next shots came slamming into the side of the gully. While Buck fired back, Casey crawled out of the open end and slid down the bank to the water's edge, pausing to listen and look around him. He then started to work his way along the creek, using the low bank for cover. He moved toward the last place he had seen muzzle flashes. After a couple of dozen yards, he paused to listen, waiting for Blanton to shoot or taunt again. While waiting, he looked around him, realizing that morning would soon be approaching. Already, the dark mass of forest was slowly beginning to take the shape of individual trees as the fragile light of pre-dawn began to filter through the forest. Suddenly, a rifle shot rang out behind him. Without either man knowing it, Casey had evidently moved silently past the position that Blanton had just reached near a laurel thicket. It struck him that one little slip or dislodged pebble could have ended his role in the game if Blanton had heard it. Casey immediately turned back to level his rifle at the thicket. Straining to make out a form in the confusion of branches, he could not determine man from bush. With no real target, he opened fire. Quickly moved to a new spot where the bank rose to create a 10-foot hummock above the water. Hurrying to go over the top of the hummock, he was suddenly slammed in the chest with a blow that staggered him like a kick from a horse. Knocked off balance, he fell from the hummock, landing in the water. A faint image of a man with a rifle pointed at him. The last thing he remembered before losing consciousness. Standing in the deep shadows beyond the thicket, Roy Blanton hurried to the creek bank to make sure the young deputy was finished. He made it to the top of the hummock. He got off one more shot before Casey's body drifted beyond the log extending into the water. He remained standing on the bank for a few moments more to see if the body was going to bob out from under the log again. when it appeared that it wasn't, a smug grin slowly spread across Blanton's face.
You're next, Buck Avery. You're next.
Back in the gully, Buck was left to wonder about the exchange of gunfire, because it was obvious none of the shots had been aimed in his direction. Knowing Casey must have encountered Blanton somewhere near the creek, he was undecided whether or not he should go in search of him or stay put. It took but a moment to make the decision. He figured it was the best chance he would have to get out of the gully where he'd been under siege all night long. Over the side he went, just as the first rays of the morning sun began to probe the deep woods and shapes and forms started to take on definition. Moving cautiously, taking only a few steps at a time before stopping to probe the awakening forest, he advanced toward the creek. His rifle ready, his finger on the trigger, he inched forward, listening for any sound that would cause him to react instantly.
Turn and you're dead.
Buck froze.
Well, Roy, looks like you got the jump on me.
Looks that way, don't it? The day'll never come when you can outsmart me. That young deputy you were riding with found that out a few minutes ago. Now, suppose you drop that rifle on the ground and turn around. I've been wanting to have a little chat with you.
Buck started to turn.
Drop the rifle first.
Buck slowly opened his hand and let the rifle drop to the ground before turning around to face his old adversary.
Been a long time since me and you faced off like this. That time, I let you walk away.
After I gave you $15,000. Hell, Buck, you're a bigger crook than me. Then, after you spent all the money, you come back and start riding my tail again. That makes you a low-down, double-dealing son of a bitch.
We had a deal.
Buck's hand casually hovered over the handle of his holstered pistol.
You wasn't supposed to come back in the nations with your robbing and killing. Hell, ain't Texas big enough for you?
You killed my sons, destroyed my family, and that trumps any deals we might have had.
Hell, Roy. We're both getting too damn old for this. That was a damn shame about your boys. But that was old Casey's doing. You know these young hotheads. Can't reason with them at all, just gun everybody down. Me and you. Why, we deserve a peaceful retirement. Why don't we just cut us a couple of poles and go fishing somewhere?
Like I said, Buck, the day ain't ever come when you could outsmart me. Now, if you hurry, you can catch up with your partner before he gets to the gates of hell.
It was close. There was not much more than a fraction of a second between Blanton's rifle and Buck's pistol. Both men staggered, but only Buck, mortally wounded, sank to the ground, having the disadvantage of being forced to draw his pistol. With a .44 slug lodged in his hip, Blanton forced himself to limp over to finish the job on the big deputy. While Buck stared helplessly up at his execution, Blanton pointed the rifle at his face.
This is for Junior and Buster and Zeke and Billy, and for this!
He held his left arm up to show the stump. A bullet in his shoulder from Casey's .44 spun him around. He saw the wounded deputy crawling up from the water, aiming to shoot again. The bullet blew a chunk of Roy Blanton's skull clean off. With one hand pressing the wound in his chest, Casey made his way painfully along the creek bank, watching for some sign of movement from Blanton's body. When he saw that part of Blanton's skull was missing, there was no doubt that Blanton was dead. That confirmed, Casey made his way to Buck. The old deputy marshal's eyes flickered open when Casey knelt beside him.
Dead. Let's see if we can help you sit up.
No. Let me be.
Buck closed his eyes for a few seconds, then opened them again.
I thought you was dead.
No, not yet.
I done some things I ain't proud of.
While pulling himself up from the creek, uncertain if his gun would even fire, Casey had heard enough to know what Buck was referring to. He couldn't say that he was totally surprised or shocked to hear it. There'd been many clues, even in the first weeks they had ridden together. He had just never considered that a lawman of Buck's reputation could have taken a bribe from the likes of Roy Blanton. Kneeling here now, watching the final minutes of the territory's most respected deputy marshal, he could see no purpose in sullying that respect.
Hell, Buck. We've all done things we ain't proud of. But you cleared the territory of the Blanton gang. That's something you can be proud of.
Yeah. I reckon we turned out to be a pretty good team. I don't think I ever partnered with any man as good as you. Oh, don't be talking about things you're gonna regret saying after I get you back to Fort Smith. I'll bandage that wound and we'll rest up for a bit before we start back. I'm done, partner. I ain't leaving this valley. Yes, you. I ain't feeling too good. Let me talk while I still can.
Blood welled up with each cough. Casey thought he was already in the process of dying, but Buck fought for time. He had something he was determined to say.
Promise me you'll do something for me. I ain't got no family. The closest thing I ever had to family is Friendship Petite. When you get back to Fort Smith, go see Frenchie. Frenchie's an honest man. Tell him I said to tell you how to find my cabin on the Kiyomishi.
You gotta quit that kind of talk. We'll go back to Frenchie's together.
Damn it, will you let me talk? The cabin's yours now. That and anything you can dig up. Under the back cornerstone.
Seemingly exhausted by his effort to speak, he lay back and closed his eyes. A trace of a smile crept across the big lawman's face.
You're a good man, partner.
So are you, partner.
Casey sat there for a while, almost forgetting the hole just below his shoulder, until the throbbing returned to remind him that he was still alive. The realization of that was enough to alert him that he still had obstacles to overcome himself. He was wounded, and he wasn't sure how bad. But he was breathing, and he wasn't spitting up any blood. The sun popped up over the hill behind him, sending light through the dense forest and giving birth to a bright new morning. He sat there for a long while, trying to make sense of everything that had just happened. There was guilt on his conscience also. He had promised Mabel March that he would take care of Bonnie, and that bothered his mind. After a while, he decided there wasn't much he could have done differently to prevent the woman's death. It was time now to take care of Buck.
Got a hole in my chest, and it's a long ride to Fort Smith, but I'll damn sure get there.
As usual, Casey Dixon accomplished what he had set out to do. He made it back to Fort Smith and brought Buck Avery's body with him, determined to see that the late deputy marshal got the burial he deserved. His report to John Council stressed the faithful performance of duty on the part of Buck Avery. Council was properly grieved by the loss of his oldest deputy, and he thanked Casey for returning the body. He insisted that the young deputy should take some time to recuperate from the wound that was already showing signs of healing, even though the bullet was still inside. Remembering his promise to Buck, his next stop was the Deuce of Spades to give Frenchy Petite the news of Buck's death. He found the gray-haired man seated at a back table, working on his ledgers. When he was told the news, he didn't say anything for a long moment. Then he just shook his head in disbelief.
Buck dead. I didn't think the day would come, but I reckon it had to, just like for everybody else.
He continued to stare at the ledger before him on the table, his mind obviously elsewhere.
Buck and me, we go a long way back.
Then he raised his head and cocked an eye at Casey.
Did he tell you to tell me anything?
He just said to have you tell me how to find his cabin on the Kiyomishi. He said he wanted me to have it.
Frenchy paused again, studying the young man seated across the table from him.
Charlotte, bring us some coffee.
He turned back to Casey.
We got some things we gotta talk about, partner.
While Casey puzzled over that, Frenchy sat back and waited for Charlotte to bring in the coffee. He waited until she went back to the kitchen.
When you two were in town a week or so ago, Buck went to see that young lawyer Ashton and had him draw up a will. Buck damn sure must have liked you because he left everything he owned to you. Not only that cabin of his, but half ownership of the Deuce of Spades. Thought a lot of you, son. I don't think he wanted you to wind up down and out without a pot to piss in like most lawmen do.
A half hour later, almost staggered by the news of his sudden wealth, still somewhat in a state of shock, Casey Dixon walked out of the Deuce of Spades. He stood for a moment on the sidewalk, studying a map that Frenchy had drawn roughly, showing him how to find the cabin and whatever was buried under the back corners. After a moment, he climbed in the saddle and turned the sorrel toward the south end of the street. As he approached the door of the cook's corner, a couple walked out. He could not avoid the sudden sting in his heart, even though his expression didn't expose it. He nodded politely.
Oh, Casey, I heard about Buck Avery. We're so sorry.
Yeah, I'm gonna miss him. I heard you two got married. Congratulations.
Casey nodded to Jared Ashton.
I'll be by to see you in a week or so.
He tipped his hat then and nudged the sorrel. Charity stood watching for a moment as he rode away. Then she turned to her husband.
What is he coming to see you for?
I imagine to get copies of Avery's will. It's amazing, but that old deputy marshal owned half of the Deuce of Spades plus some other property, and he left it all to Dixon.
Well, damn.
What's that?
Oh, nothing, dear. Let's be on our way.
Shootout at Broken Bow is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2009. Charles G. West. Published by arrangement with NAL Signet, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Danny Gavigan, Thomas Keegan, Terrence Aselford, Bradley Smith, David Korn, Eric Mesner, Richard Rowan, Kimberly Gilbert, David Harris, Julianne Elliott, Yasmin Toisan, James Konachek, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Gregory Gordon, Michael Glenn, Tim Pabone, Tim Carlin, Johann Detweiler, Lynette Savard, Thomas Penny, Lily Beacon, Nick DePinto, Colleen Delaney, Ren Casey, Evan Casey, Scott McCormick, James Lewis, Tony Nam, and Nathaniel Perry. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaway. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beamer. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Thomas Hogan and Allison Thomas. Graphic audio sound design by Allison Thomas. Additional music by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Shootout at Broken Bow, be sure to listen to Charles G. West Tanner's Law and William W. Johnstone's Family Jensen, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it.
What kind of sheriff are you anyway?
Where will it stop? Who will stop the crime wave? Is our bank next? Will our citizens lie dead in the streets? Fire him!
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Cotton Pickens, Book 4, Massacre Mountain.
Some got blown. I got a whiff of powder or something.
I'll get Sanders. You stay here and stay armed. Don't know what's in the building or the bushes.
Having the right man wearing the star is important to a business like mine. I sell good times, Sheriff. There's lawmen that just don't like anyone having a good time in their towns, and then there's trouble.
Arrest the whole lot! Arrest Ralston! We can't have this! Doubtful's reputation is ruined!
For what?
For public indecency.
I don't know any law like that, Mr. Mayor.
Then invent one! I want them out of my town by morning!
Arrest them for lewd behavior. They were virtually disrobing the girl with their gaze, demeaning her, reducing her to their own animal lust.
Well, that's kind of nice, ma'am. But I'm still sheriff, far as I can figure, and I aim to get my badge back real quick now. And if I do, you'll get your money back. You put me in an opera house with naked women, and I cease to think. I don't even have a pipsqueak of a thought between my ears.
That is how we all are in the presence of the divine. You have eyes for ambrosia.
I hear you want to marry me. So, let's talk.
Name your deal.
I'll marry you for 1 month.
I don't think I could swing that.
What do you think I am? I don't believe in free love.
You're expensive, all right.
Cotton Pickens, Book 4, Massacre Mountain.
Available now in graphic audio.
Maybe I should go get myself baptized before they shut me down. Once you've been pushed underwater, wearing all white, they leave you alone.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.